You're listening to the Sound Atlas.
Hey there, I'm your host, Captain Dean, and on this episode, I'm sitting down with an incredibly talented guitarist that has been heavily involved in the local music scene for many, many years, most notably in bands like Gear, Undead Anna, Atomic Pimp Hand, and Boomstick. Wade England, welcome to the Sound Atlas. the crowd goes wild. Yeah. How's it going?
Man, I can't complain.
Well, good, because today is all about you and no complaints.
Yay, me day.
Where do we begin with most of these is where are you from?
I was born and raised in Glasgow, pretty much. Well, I was born in Glasgow, spent most of my time growing up in Park City.
Okay.
Kind of lived on a farm up until probably right around my freshman year, and then I moved to the fabulous metropolis of Cave City.
Cave City,
yeah.
Yes.
So I kind of did the Cave City thing while I was in high school. I went to Barron County still, but lived in Cave City, hung out with all the Cave Cityans, and almost ended up going to Caverna High School because they told me if I went there I could play basketball.
Ah.
And I was a big basketball nut
right.
back in the day.
So. Starting up in that neck of the woods, what got you into music?
When I was growing up and was a kid, I kind of grew up, I was a hip hop head, man. I liked rap music. Like in probably 85 or 86, I think the first cassette, because, you know, we bought cassettes back then. The first cassette I owned was Run DMC, Raising Hell.
Raising Hell, I was going to say.
I got that, and I got Beastie Boys, License to Ill, and Fat Boys Crushing, kind of all three around the same area, same time frame. And I don't know, I just grew up, of course, Run DMC, that album had a lot of guitar samples on it. And so
right,
did,
Rick Rubin produced
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so did the Beastie Boys stuff. So I just kind of always liked that. My dad always listened to country, like Hank Jr. and, you know, Skinner and all that kind of stuff, which I despised back in the day. Hated it. My mom always kind of listened to a lot of 80s pop music, so I kind of got my love for the 80s with that.
Right.
And I really never got into rock and roll up until high school when the whole grunge thing hit. And you know, Alice in Chains hit, Pearl Jam, Nirvana. When Nirvana
early
Unplugged,
90s.
Yeah, Nirvana Unplugged came out, and then I graduated in '94. So, and I moved out of the house like probably in I want to say early '95, mm-hmm. maybe, and had a place of my own for a little while, and just had well, actually, I had time on my hands before that, but I got my first guitar. I was 19. I still lived in Cave City, and I got an electric. Didn't dig it. The first, you know, I was like, I don't know about this. Mm-hmm. Took it back. He let me exchange it for an acoustic.
Okay.
And
where'd you get that?
I got it at Strings and Things, which is no longer there. It's where All in Bloom Florist is.
Okay.
Up across from Hatcher and Sadler Funeral Home.
All right.
So it was there. Tim Hodges ran it. And I don't know, I just went in there, and he was real cool. He let me switch it for an acoustic. It was a Vantage acoustic. And I remember when I got it, man, my mom used to make me practice in the basement. And where we lived, like, it wasn't a basement like what we're in here where
right.
it has, like, floors. I mean, it was like a dingy old nasty basement, you know. And she made me practice down there because I was terrible.
Humble beginnings.
I was terrible. And, you know, she told me, and I remind her this often, she said, I don't know why you wasted your time or your money on that guitar. You're never going to learn how to play that thing.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, mother's love. But that's kind of what got me into it. And at that time, I think that was right around the era of Nirvana Unplugged. And
yeah,
so,
Nirvana Unplugged came out in 94?
Yeah, 94, yeah. 95, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And some of the first songs I learned how to play were off of that. And I think the first like cool song I learned how to play all the way through was Pearl Jam Black.
Oh.
And so I did the acoustic thing.
So you got started playing guitar out of high school.
Yeah, I was 19.
Wow.
Yeah, I kind of got started late. And really the funny thing about it is I kind of just did it because I'd always heard in high school I was into art. I sketch, draw, paint, whatever. Right. I was in the art club, president of the art club. And I actually, my dream was to go to college and be an art teacher, which kind of fell through. But I don't know. I just had always heard that if you were artistically talented at all,
right,
then you could pick up on music. So I was like,
They do seem to go hand in hand. And a lot of people that are artists that don't play instruments seem to be really big music fans.
Yeah.
You know, like a guy like Jim Madison comes to mind. I mean, this guy absorbs music like a sponge. I mean, he's like the greatest radio station that doesn't exist.
Right.
But yet he creates art. And just, you know, it just goes to show that music and art are very much a family thing. You know, at least that's the way I've always looked at it.
Well, my grandpa on my mom's side, he had a guitar and played a little bit. And
I was going to ask you, was there any kind of connection growing up?
Honestly, there wasn't any. Like, there was always music in the house, right, like being on the radio and stuff, and, you know, little get-togethers, and there was always music. And I grew up in old school Baptist church, so there was always that kind of music. Yeah. And I don't know, I just kind of always heard it. And then, like, I was lucky in grade school. I rode a bus. Troy Simpson, rest in peace, he's been gone for a while. But anyways, he drove my bus. And he was one of the – this was back in the days when, you know, if you drove a bus, you could do whatever. You could put – if you wanted a radio, you could do it. So this was one of the cool buses. Like, he had a radio and speakers. So, you know, when we was going to school, there was music on. So that's pretty much there was always music on, music around. I never played any instruments. My grandpa had a guitar. I would see it every now and then and –
like, but you didn't really dabble.
I wasn't allowed to touch it.
He didn't teach you anything?
No, absolutely not. And I only saw him play it like 3 or 4 times. I mean, he was by no means a guitar player. He knew like...
just piddled.
Yeah, G, C, and D. And then my great uncle, Elam, which I actually have his guitar still, he lived with my grandma, and he would play this guitar. And he always says, oh, this is a left-handed guitar, which it was, and he just didn't know it better and played it upside down. He couldn't play, but... It was pretty much one of those deals. Like, I had a lot of time on my hands, and I thought, I'll buy a guitar. We'll see what happens. And the way that I'm wired and my brain works, just like with anything, I'm super competitive and super like...
You're kind of an all or nothing personality.
Exactly. Yeah, when I get into something, like, I'm going all the way, you know? So it was kind of one of those deals. And I had, you know, especially when I moved out of the house, I'd been playing maybe 6 months, and I moved out and had a little time before I started my next job. And I just thought, you know, I'll give it a go. And, you know, I'd sit around for 8 hours at a time just goofing off on this guitar. And then
but
I remember
dedicated to it.
Oh, yeah, like, I was. I mean, really, I practiced a lot. And luckily, when I started my job where I work now, I'm getting ready to retire from. When I started there, one of the guys that worked there played guitar. And I asked him, hey, will you give me a couple lessons? And he did. And he was kind enough to let me. We kind of had this little band. It was called Skillet Lickers. And he was kind enough to just let me be there and bang on my acoustic.
Right.
And I was terrible. And I think I played with him for like 6 months. It really helped me get a lot better because he was a seasoned musician. He'd been playing forever. And we did a little Halloween party. Mm-hmm. And I used to have a cassette. Like, I played my first little lead on, like, Suzy Q or something, you know?
That's cool.
So, it kind of went from there.
So, that was your first band?
Yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah, first band.
Kind of a guesting role in something.
Well, no, I was in it, and then I got kicked out because I was terrible. But, again, like
you learned from it.
Well, it was the same thing. It was like with my mom saying, hey, why'd you buy that guitar? Like, I got kicked out of the band. I was like, well, I'll show you.
Yeah.
You know, so it kind of lit that fire under me. And then probably shortly after that, Chad Lockhart, which I had known in school, and, you know, we played basketball together. He played basketball. I sat on the bench. But, you know, we ran around. We had a lot of the same interests. He had the same love for rap music, and, you know, we used to go to high school dances, and we liked to dance and that kind of stuff, you know, but I had no idea he played guitar. And I think he graduated in, like, 92, so he'd been out of school a couple
years.
And I just kind of saw him one day, and I don't even know how it came up, but I think I called him, and he was, like, noodling on his guitar, and I was like, I didn't know you played guitar. And so we just kind of started hanging out, and what I would do is on my lunch break, I would drive to his house, and we would just spend the lunch break. He's a drummer too,
right?
You know, not a true drummer, but he's decent. Mm-hmm. And we would just sit there, and we'd pick, you know, we had like 7 songs we'd just go through, wow, on lunch break. And we did that for probably 6 months, maybe.
So what did that lead into?
That led into Gear.
Gear.
Yeah. Yeah, so we did that and did that, and he was like, man, you know, we should try to get a band together. Yeah. And I was like, dude, I don't know any musicians. And somehow, I think he knew Jake, which I knew Jake Ritchie,
right,
from just, I used to see him in high school, you know, he was playing, and we'd go to like the Armory or wherever, and right, he would always be playing with somebody.
Yeah.
So I had seen him around, didn't know him, never talked to him, but I'd seen him play drums, mm-hmm, and I thought he was good drummer. Chad kind of knew who he was, and then Chad worked with I don't know if he worked with, no, I think Curtis Wilson, which was our first bass player, he worked at Donnelly's at the time, I think, but him and Chad knew each other. They had played at some point because Chad was in a couple other bands,
right?
And he called Curtis, and which it was really funny because the four of us, me and Chad, were pretty tight. We didn't know – I didn't know Curtis. I didn't know Jake. But it just kind of came together and clicked, and we started playing and ended up being Gear.
Coming into this interview,
mm-hmm,
I think if you look back at everything that's been aired leading up to your episode being aired currently,
mm-hmm,
I think your name has come up more than anybody.
And I think probably because I'm a band whore, man.
Because a lot of people will drop names about, well, mm-hmm, I saw this band, or mm-hmm, I used to go hang out with these guys. And the word Gear keeps popping up, especially so far that I've been hosting,
yeah,
these. And I've obviously talked to a lot of people from the Glasgow, you know, connection and everything. So obviously Gear had a pretty strong impact in the music scene because of the timing. I think musically, mm-hmm, and the era that you all came about, it fit perfectly with what was happening, not only locally, but nationally.
Well, the music scene then was strong, really strong, not just in Bowling Green and Glasgow, too. I mean, you had... of course, Super Fuzz, yeah, you know, everybody wanted to be Super Fuzz.
Oh,
that's first time I saw him. I was like, and it was, I think I saw him at Toy Tiger in Louisville. They opened for Days of the New. And as soon as I saw Angstrom come out with that guitar, yeah, on, I was like, I want to do that.
Yeah.
You know? And so all of us around here were heavily influenced by Angstrom. And it kind of all goes back to Kenny Weber at Backstage Music.
Okay.
I mean, he taught pretty much every band you've ever heard of that came out of Glasgow.
Yeah.
You can trace them back to Kenny. I mean, Kenny taught the Kenny Weber, or Kenny taught the Dave Angstroms and Johnny McGee's and all those guys how to, okay, play guitar. And then that kind of started a scene. But at that time, it was like, you know, out of Glasgow, it was Gear, you know, Super Fuzz, which they had kind
of
at that point.
More of a Lexington,
they were almost, yeah, they were elect, yeah, but they were from Glasgow.
Yeah, they've got roots.
You know,
this.
You had Tail Dragger. Temple Hill.
Yeah.
Temple Hill and Gear, we kind of...
You guys did play a lot of shows
together. We played a lot of shows together.
I saw a lot of flyers,
yeah,
with your
own. And Jake played with Temple Hill, too.
Right.
So that's kind of... It all... It was kind of like that, what is it, 7 degrees of Kevin Baker,
yeah,
5 degrees, however many degrees. You know, it's like everybody knew everybody. But the scene was pretty strong back then. We had a lot of all ages venues we could play,
yep,
and you know, back then too, people would have backyard parties.
Now, when did this actually take hold? When did Gear form?
Gear formed in 90, probably late 95, early 96.
I was gonna say 96, 97.
Yeah, probably 96, 97 is probably, yeah, when we actually started playing out. I think the first actual true show we played in a bar was probably 96, and that would have been at was it? It used to be called the Orange Bar, and then it was called, it's where the Silverado is now. And Norma Jean, a lady named Norma Jean.
Yeah, I remember it being Norma Jean.
It was, I forget, the Zoo Bar. That's what it was called.
Yeah, yeah.
The Zoo Bar. So that was kind of our first gig. We played with Temple Hill.
There needs to be an episode just of names of clubs
There were so many.
That's so hard to keep up with.
But we did that. I mean, that, of course, there was different lineups and gear. When it started out, it was me and Chad on guitar, him singing, Curtis on bass, and then Jake on drums.
Okay.
And then...
Who was the second...
The second phase, Jake left, and a guy named David Robbins came in on drums. Yeah. And then during that time, Curtis was a little bit older than us, and Curtis was more of a funk bass player. Right. Curtis was a real musician, you know, where we were just kind of hacks. He was a real musician, you know, he could
study. Them,
he knew his instrument. I mean, yeah. Honestly, dude, the first like 2 or 3 years we played with Curtis, I remember me and him went to, I think we rode up to Louisville to see Superfuzz one night. And like a live song came on the radio, and he's like, "Oh, that's how that goes." Because we'd been playing it for 2 years, and he had never heard it. He just kind of played whatever he thought went,
it was the exact same thing
they were playing. And so eventually, he kind of started hitting that he was going to leave. And I knew even at that time how hard it was to find a bass player.
Yeah.
So I would go to the music store and just hang out. I would always pick up a bass and try to learn, you know. Try to get to where I could play it with my fingers and all that kind of stuff. And
eventually you did.
Yeah, well, Curtis left, and Chad was like, "We got to find another bass player, you know." And I was like, "Let me play bass." And he was all against it because he's like, "No, you need
player.
We got to have two guitars, you know." And finally, after we tried a couple of bass players out, I was just like, "Dude, it's not working. Let's try it one time."
Okay.
So that's when we became three-piece and played. And so it was me, Chad, and Dave on drums. And the first show we played as a three-piece, Dean Smith came in and sat in the table in front of me. And I was just like...
And you're like,
I was like, really? Come on. Come on, man. So that lasted for a while. And then the whole Dave thing, I don't really remember how that fizzled out, but he ended up leaving, and then we got Matt DeVore.
I completely forgot.
Yeah.
That was in
well, there. That's probably like our. We never really had any success that I would say, but Center of Gravity was kind of our CD that came out that everybody liked. And that's probably the most we played and the most we got out and got exposure was with that lineup.
And it seemed like you did because I recall seeing your name again, like on several posters, several show flyers and billings and stuff. So I was aware of your band long before I even knew you.
Yeah.
So that was my introduction to just hearing who you were, you know. Yeah. And so how long did Gear last as far as the band?
Gear lasted until about, let's see, I was 20, about 17 years ago. So what was that, 2002-ish?
Yes.
So around 2002, 2000s when we released
Center, not a bad run though.
Center of Gravity, and then 2002 is when I kind of took a hiatus, had some personal things going on, and just I was kind of ready to step away from music.
Okay.
And
Gear comes to an end.
No, Gear didn't come to an end. I bowed out, and John Shirley came in and played bass, and they did that for a while. That probably didn't even last a year, maybe, and. Then, I went through a divorce and some things like that. Mm. And I got to the point where I was like, I'd really like to play music again. And I remember me and Chad went to, I think it was it Kelly Green's? It may have been right after Kelly Green's. It might have been 425 Park Row at the time, but it's where Kelly Green's was
Kelly
on
Green's,
the square.
Yeah, Kelly Green's, Vicks, yeah. Brewing Company.
Yeah, yeah. Stuff. So we went up there and saw Superfuzz one night. And it was just one of those things. I was like, dude, we got it. Well, actually, the thing about it was Dave got us up on stage.
Oh.
So I think we played Long Way Home. Chad got up there. I don't remember if Chad played or if he just sang, but Jason, the bass player at the time, Jason Groves, like middle of the song, hands me his bass. Well, I knew every Superfuzz song, so I'll never forget it. I was back there just playing bass, just, cheesing because it was like, oh my God, I'm playing with Superfuzz. And Angstrom looks back just surprised that I'm back there, So after that, we were just kind of, man, we got to get this going back again. So
it's obvious that you need to do this.
Yeah. Right,
even
so
at that point.
So then Jake came, we got Jake back, and we did like maybe a year and a half run did some shows as a three piece, me, Chad, and Jake, me on bass.
Still under the name Gear.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Steel Gear, because it was all, it was still original
right,
members.
Steel Gear
yeah.
material and everything.
And we recorded like a five or six song deal that never saw the light of day.
I hate hearing that.
Yeah, I think we've got like probably, I know we've got three of the songs somewhere, like Jake's got them. But I think there was like three or four that just kind of got lost. Cause
Jake needs to upload those somewhere.
Oh, he's got them. Jake, that's one thing about Jake. Like any band he was ever a part of, he's got everything they ever did.
I do the same
which
thing.
I'm the opposite. I have nothing I've ever done, you know. But we recorded it down here in the basement, actually.
That's cool. And, yeah, speaking of that, we are in your home studio in Glasgow.
Yeah.
Beautiful downtown Glasgow.
Yeah,
This is the second episode I've recorded in Glasgow, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, this is the, as Ken Massey has named it, the Tortuga Tavern.
The Tortuga Tavern.
Yeah. I used to call it Electric Pirate Studios, but apparently...
Which I always thought was a great name.
Yeah.
You know, that's such a cool
name.
Well,
it started out because I worked for the electric company and all the software I used to record my bands was pirated software.
That's brilliant.
That's where it came from. The electric pirate.
That sounded like such a common thing, but it actually has purpose.
Yeah, oh yeah, it has meaning.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
All right, so going back to that, you do like a second run of Gear in a way. It finally does kind of come to an end. Where did you go from that?
Well, when that kind of ended, I don't want to say I was bitter. I wasn't bitter that it ended. I was upset.
Right.
And in my mind, I kind of had something to prove because I'd played bass in bands as three piece. But I hadn't played guitar in a long time, and I just had this mindset that, you know, I'm going to show people that I can still do that. So me, Jake Ritchie, and at the time, Brad Osbrooks got together.
Wow.
And I'm trying to remember how I met Brad. I think I met Brad back in the Gear days. I think I got my first tattoo from Brad. No. I got my first tattoo from Wes. Somehow or another, me and Brad ended up hooking up. I don't know how. Maybe Marlon.
It didn't seem like that point, a lot of the music and tattoo guys kind of ran around together.
Well, I think Marlon knew him. My wife knew him from college because they had some art classes together. And somehow or another, we got together. But we started trying out singers. And we got a guy named Marcus McNeese, who was, I think, originally from Ohio. And we just kind of did this thing. We recorded a little, I think it was like an eight song CD. And it was real, a lot of people thought it was very Deftones-ish just because of his vocal style and the things he did. A lot of really overprocessed vocals, you know, distorted chorus on them and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And we had a pretty good run. We did a lot of stuff in Louisville, had pretty good success there. But that, for me, that was just kind of proving, hey, I can still play guitar without having to be in Gear, you know.
Right. And that was the band Stutterbox.
That was the band Stutterbox. That was very short lived, maybe a year.
So kind of more of a Louisville thing. Did you play in
Bowling Green. We played we played over on campus a few times. Played at just some random stuff around Bowling Green. But we kinda, I don't wanna say we had a following in Louisville, but every time we played in Louisville people seemed to enjoy it. And it just, for some reason or another, it didn't work out. And Jake and I were still wanting to keep going, keep playing. And I think Brad was just kind of burned out on it. So he kind of went his own way. And we tried out a bass player, Jimmy Favorman, which ended up being a good friend of mine. He lives in Nashville now. But he ended up playing bass for us. And Jonathan Treadway ended up being our vocalist, and we called that Fear of Silence. Kind of the same deal. We had a little, you know, a little EP that we put out. We played a lot in Bowling Green, played a lot in Louisville still, just because at that time Louisville was really into the heavier music, and we kind of fit that bill. Because at that point, I was really kind of angry too, you know, just because my band that I thought, oh, this is what I'm gonna do for a living.
I'm gonna make it.
Yeah, and I was real upset about that didn't work out. So I had a lot of anger and going through a divorce. I had a lot of anger. So we played some really angry, screaming metal music, you know, tuned down to like C and just.
But, you know, that's better than therapy.
It was. And at that time, you know, at that time it was popular, you know, Machine Head, stuff like that was kind of a big deal.
What year was this?
That would have been.
Early 2000s?
Yeah, probably early to mid 2000s, I guess. Yeah.
And so that band didn't last too long. But
yeah, I think Fear of Silence. Stirbox and Fear of Silence both kind of had about the same shelf life.
Okay.
And about that time, I think that was about the time John King called and said, hey, you know, we might be getting ready to fire our bass player.
And you were Sixth Floor's bass player.
Yeah.
And do you know what number you were?
I was three.
You were the third.
I was the third, yeah. Because it was Dave, Rob, and then me.
That's the one thing about them that I never really knew.
Yeah.
I knew they had bass players.
Yeah.
Kind of like the Spinal Tap.
It really was.
They had the bass player
it
thing.
It really was.
And I've seen the pictures, but I never really knew what time frame and who was what. So.
Well, the funny thing about that is that was about the time me and Marla, my wife now, met. And we went to St. Louis with them for a show that they did, because we were all friends, because back in the day, Gear and 6-4, we'd play shows together all the time. So I was friends with those guys, and we went up with them to St. Louis just to hang out and watch them. I'll never forget, we went and watched them that night, and they played a great show, and we were all sitting at the bar, and I'd had a few drinks, and Rob, their bass player at the time, came up and sat by me, and we were talking about equipment, and I was like, yeah, you know, you really sounded good. And just, you know, something hit me, and I was like, you know, if you ever screw up, I'm taking your job, right? And he just looked at me with this look like he was laughing, you know, like, ah, that's a funny joke. And I was just like, no, I'm serious. If you ever screw up, I'm taking your job. So I did. But that was probably – I had a long run with 6-4, probably.
Yeah, what was that? At least four?
Yeah, probably four years. I think we did a couple albums I was on, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a good time, man. We played a lot of cool shows, did a lot of cool things that I never thought I'd get to do. I'd say the pinnacle of that was opening up for Disturbed at Jillian's in Louisville. Probably still the biggest crowd I ever played in front of. But, and then, you know, I was getting to the age. I'd always set a limit for myself, you know. If by the time I turned 30, I haven't made it doing this music thing, which I was still working, obviously. But I just always said, you know, after 30, it's just for fun. I'm not living that whole pipe dream again.
The Nashville rule, as far as that I know, is they do have a shelf life when they look at someone. Yeah. But, you know, I think that's kind of fallen away side a little bit today.
I do too.
But
I think
also the big labels and getting signed and being 20 at the time, they don't look at you and go, well, if this band sticks together and makes hits for 20 years, there's my retirement.
I mean, that really doesn't happen anymore. And making it is not what it used to be. I mean,
I think making it now is if you can afford to just simply be a musician.
Yeah, if you can play music for a living,
A living as in if you're married and your significant other can afford to pay the bulk of it and you do okay.
Yeah.
And then you can go out on the road and do okay. I know a lot of bands that do that. You know, like in our eyes, they're well known.
Right.
But in reality, they get off the road and get jobs through temp services until they get back on the road. So
they're doing what they love.
It's a different time. It really is. But, you know, I think it's still very much alive and well.
Mm-hmm.
It's just different.
Yeah.
And so it's people have found ways to adjust.
Right.
And so I've always thought that was kind of cool. So coming out of 6-4.
Yeah. Well, so that was, I was about to turn 30. Mm-hmm. And, I think I did turn 30, and
you really did set your limit.
Yeah, and I did. And,
happy birthday to me. Okay, I'm going to quit this.
Well, no, I think I was in there for like a little while after I turned 30. But at the time, too, Marla and I just got married, and we were talking about, you know, hey, if we're going to start a family, we need to do it. I'm not getting any younger.
Yeah, you don't.
And so we decided to try to do that.
Wait
and,
till you're 45.
And, you know, I sat down with John and our manager at the time and just told him, you know, I'll finish out the shows, but after this, I kind of go, I got to go do my own thing.
Right.
And so Marla ended up getting pregnant, and I didn't play a whole lot then. And then kind of my thing was, while she was pregnant, I started a little blues thing here in the basement. It was just me and a few other people just kind of getting together and jamming. It was, the drummer was like a, I think the music teacher at her, the middle school where she worked at the time. Oh, cool. And we just got together.
You kind of had like your own personal blues jams in a
way. Yeah, pretty much. And we did that for a while. And then that turned into what became the Randy, I was just going to call it Randy Watson. Because I was a big Coming to America fan.
Yeah, I was about to say.
And the great thing was, is everybody thought somebody, it was kind of like Pink Floyd. Everybody thought there was a person in the band named
which
Randy.
Which one's
Watson.
Randy?
But we had Beverly, a girl named Beverly, lady named Beverly, who I actually saw at a black church that Curtis went to. And he had, they were having band practice. And the only white person there besides me watching it was Beverly, and she was singing, Beverly Garrett, and I was like, man, this chick can sing. And I had been, the other thing, back when I listened to hip-hop a lot, like I remember the first time I heard Muddy Waters' Mannish Boy, like there was something that clicked in my mind that said, there's, I don't know what that is,
right,
but I like it. And so every time I would hear blues, I just really like dove real deep into it. And even while I was doing the Gear thing and all these other bands, like I would always be listening to like Stevie Ray Vaughan, Buddy Guy, Muddy Waters, Helen Wolf. And so we ended up, I asked her, I was like, you know, you sing pretty good. Do you like blues? She's like, yeah. Do you want to be in a band? And she thought I was kidding, you know. But I don't know. She said, yeah. And then, after so many just kind of messing around, hooked up with Brad Bruton, who was in Skillet Liquors, my first band.
Oh, okay.
And he played bass and sang some, and then Beverly sang, and
it's like
Lee,
the circle of
yeah,
music going on.
Lee Hammer came into the picture, blowing harmonica.
Absolutely.
And who was, I think Charlie Payne was drumming, and Anthony Kinney from the Headhunters kind of came into the picture because Brad knew him, and like he came
that's
in.
Not a bad line.
Oh, it was great, dude. It was like blues education 101 for me, because Anthony's like, out of all the guitar players I've seen, and especially all of them I've had.
We've had this conversation before.
I mean, this guy
sat me down one day and just went into this 15-minute talk about how Anthony's
he's like the
incredible.
Most he's the most amazing musician
I've
ever
to
been in a
room
with.
But you get one on one in a private setting with
I'm
him.
Telling you, like we used to every. Once a week, we would get together down here. We didn't even play out much. We played a few shows. But we would get down here once a week. And at the time, I was playing Mexican Fender Stratocasters. And Anthony was playing a Tele. And we'd just kind of make a joke of it. We would have chips and salsa and Mexican beer. And so it was just like a big Mexican fest playing blues. And we'd just sit down here, man, have the greatest times ever. And, you know, like, I was just in awe. But, like, he really kind of taught me, too, how to play with another guitar player, how to lay back and just kind of play off each other. And, like, to this day, he's probably still the best guitar player I've ever witnessed.
And I think a lot of people will just never get that, because I've never seen that.
Well, he doesn't play out
much. We're all used to him being a bass player.
Yeah, and he's a great bass player, excellent bass player. And he can play drums. He can do everything. He can sing. But, like, just the way he plays and his style and his taste and just – I've never seen a dude take a Telecaster and plug straight into a clean Fender amp and make it sound like that.
It's amazing.
I was just like, man, you know.
It's so cool when it's, like, it's coming through you know, the body. It's them as much as what they're using and going through. That's cool. What year was all that?
Oh, wow. That would have been 2007-ish, 7 or 8, because
okay.
Izzy was just born. That was probably like when she was a year old, so that had been about 2008-ish, 2007.
And how long did you all do that for?
Well, we did the Randy Watson thing, which that turned into, that had a like different kind of, we did that probably for, I want to say 2 or 3 years, right. Man. And it kind of turned into Fat Mouth Mojo, which was basically the same band without Anthony. And then there was a couple different versions of that. Chuck Wells got involved in it at one point. But the constants in it were always me and Lee Hammer. Me and Lee kind of – anything blues that I did for that era was, you know, me and Lee Hammer were always in that. and had a good time doing that.
Good pairing, too.
Yeah, and same thing. Like, Lee's one of those guys where, like, you watch him play, and I was just like, oh, my God, this guy's really good.
And I've
I would find myself myself just not playing. You know, like, I'd stop playing because I'd be watching him.
Well, being that I've only got to work with Lee at, like, the blues jam stuff, and playing drums, it's like you can just kind of sit there and tap stuff. And I'm in awe of the musicians standing around me, you know, and I've had the privilege of jamming with you at some of those things. And as a drummer, you can just kind of half-ass it and enjoy the show that's going on around you.
Well, Lee's one of those guys. He's on another level.
Oh, yeah.
And he's a real humble guy. And you, like, I would always push him to step out of the, you know, give him what you can really do. Because I've seen it down here when we practice.
He seems to play for the song, though.
He does.
And
he
so
does.
You got to really.
But there's some points where, like, you got to step out
you
and really get
can,
after it.
But I guess he's so humble that he just kind of.
Well, here's the thing about Lee that I've figured out. He's like me. He's competitive. So when I would nudge him and I'd, like, we'd start swapping licks. And I always knew I was going to lose. Like, every time the only way that I could win if we did that is if I got to start first.
Oh, okay.
Because if he started first, it was over. Because if I had to match what he was doing, there's no way, you know. And every now and then I'd get
so you're
lucky.
The spark and he's
every
the
now
bonfire.
And then I would get lucky. But most of the time I would start it and he would finish it. And
that's
be
cool,
the
man. That's cool. Lee is a good guy, man. Yeah. I've been around him many times and have so much appreciation for him. So Fat Mouth Mojo.
That was really short-lived.
Short-lived, but like you said, same kind of.
Yeah, it kind of came and went. For off and on for a few years. I think the last version of it was like maybe 3 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And that was with Chuck Wales and
Shag.
So
it just kind of floated, but
yeah, we just
you did do other things around
it. Yeah, we kind of kept the name. After that, I'm trying to think.
Yeah, your timeline, I think. Where
after
did
that,
Atomic...
oh, Undead Anna fell in somewhere around.
Okay,
that,
I was gonna say,
time.
I know Atomic Pimp Hand.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. So Atomic Pimp Hand.
These all at one point you kind of ended
Atomic
up doing
Atomic
multiple
Pimp Hand kind of morphed out of the whole Randy Watson Fat Mouth Mojo.
Okay,
because Jimmy Favorman, who was in Fear Silence, also the bass player, ended up playing bass in one of the versions of the blues band we did. And Jimmy and I also did, there was like a ton of cover bands we did in garages that never even got out of the garage. And so me and him kind of played together a lot. And I think that's when we did the Atomic Pimp Hand thing. We'd been doing blues for a while, and I was just like, you know, I'm not pissed off anymore, but I'd still like to rock a little bit.
Right.
And so we kind of threw the Atomic Pimp Hand thing together. Leslie Wyatt ended up singing for us. And Andy Houchins was our drummer, which he had came in after Charlie Payne left Randy Watson and it became Fat Mouth Mojo. Andy came in doing that. And Andy was always just he was into stuff like, you know, Avenged Sevenfold, Lamb of God, that kind of stuff, right. You know, real heavy stuff. And, so we just kind of did that thing, and we had a lot of fun with Atomic Pimp Hand. We actually probably didn't play Bowling Green much at all. We just kind of would do Louisville, Nashville, Lexington, Richmond.
Again, it's kind of like you went to the scenes that seemed a little more open.
Well, the Jamestown, places like that that were into heavy music at the time, because we were strictly Atomic Pimp Hand was strictly. With the exception of maybe two covers, strictly original music. We played Billie Jean as a cover, but which sounded nothing like the Michael Jackson
version.
It was way heavier. And we might have played maybe two other covers, but we were strictly originals. And at that time, even though I was older than 30, we kind of went back to the whole let's tour a little bit thing, even though it was just regionally. You know, we had a van and a trailer, and we just...
I mean,
if
you can do it.
Yeah, on the weekends, we just go load up.
If it's fun and it's worth your time.
Yeah, and we had a lot of good times doing that. And that stopped, and then the blues thing went a little more. And then I think that's about the time that Undead Anna came around.
And that would be what year?
That would have been...
Doesn't seem like it was that long ago.
It's been probably... I want to say it's been at least 6-7 years ago.
I was
going to
say, is it around 10 years ago?
Not that long. It hadn't been that long. It was probably around 2010, 11, 12, somewhere around there. Probably 2012. maybe. I don't know. The years, yeah. You know, the years kind of go by.
I know. I'm still in the point where I say 1970, and that was 30 years ago.
It's probably been, somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 8 years ago.
Yeah. Because it doesn't seem like it was that long ago.
But it kind of was. I mean,
because Undead Anna, your band, was playing a lot of shows with Left Hand Voodoo, correct?
Right, because I was playing with both bands at the same time.
Oh, you were? See?
Well, it started out, we were playing together.
Right.
And then I ended up playing bass for Left Hand Voodoo for a long time.
Okay.
But Undead Anna.
I knew there was a connection, but I didn't know if you were actually in it for some reason.
Yeah.
But I knew you. Those two bands played a lot of shows because the names were always on like posters.
Right.
Together,
so. And I ended up getting into Left Hand Voodoo playing bass just kind of on accident.
Right.
It was kind of one of those deals. Ken, I'd become friends with those guys. Me and Ken were kind of tight. And he was just like, oh man, we lost our bass player. Can you just fill in? And I was just like,
here we go again.
I said, as long as it's a fill in, because I really didn't want to play bass at that time. I was like, yeah, if it's a fill-in, I'll do it. Which a fill-in turned into like a 2-year gig.
Mm.
And then Undead Anna we had our run, a good little run, and just...
Now, who was in Undead Anna? Because you all seemed fairly popular in that scene.
Yeah, but those guys were a lot younger than me.
Right.
Which I had no business being in that band. But I ended up in that band because I recorded a demo for them down here in my basement.
Mm-hmm.
And they...
But you kind of helped the next generation behind you kind of get a launch in a way.
I guess. And I never felt, I've never felt my age. Yeah. I always, whoever I'm around, I feel like I'm the same age.
I know.
And so we just kind of did that. And they got a bass player. We recorded the drum tracks and Kyle's guitars and vocals. And then they found a bass player to lay it down. And they didn't have another guitar player. And I was like, well, I'll lay some guitar down on it. And so I laid guitar down, and they was just like, well, why don't you just play with us until we can find somebody? And I was like, okay. And so that ended up being however long it was. And,
a couple years
at
least.
Yeah, 2 or 3 years.
Who was in Undead Anna?
It was me, Kyle Crowder, Clayton Crowder, whatever.
I think
whatever.
Everybody now calls him Clayton.
Whatever. And Reed Wilkinson and Jabel. Yeah.
Yep.
So we kind of did that, and then it kind of fell apart. We got together, did a couple shows that fell, it was just kind of one of those on and off again
so
things.
So on and off with Undead Anna, but yet you kind of end up in Left Hand Voodoo, so to speak.
I did end up in Left
you
Hand Voodoo.
You did end up permanently?
As the bass player.
And I'm assuming, if I'm not mistaken, that basically turned into what you are currently in with Boomstick.
Pretty much, yeah. We did the
because Jason was the drummer,
yeah.
If I'm not mistaken.
Well, Jason, Ken, and I were all in Left Hand Voodoo.
So who was the
Shane Williams was the other guitar player. Okay. When I was bass player, Greg, what's Greg's last name? I'm going blank. Anyways. And,
that's the worst part of doing these podcasts.
Yeah,
because
I know
you leave people
I know
out,
his last
like, shit,
name.
I'm really sorry.
I know his last name. He's gonna be like, "Oh, I hate you," but it'll come to me in like 5 minutes. But anyways, and Greg was in that, and I don't know. It just kind of got to the point where I was like, I was doing the blues thing again then too. So I had like 2 or 3 bands going on at the time. I think Undead Anna was going on at the same time, and I was still trying to do blues. And I just got to the point where I was like, look, I can't do all this.
Right.
So we kind of quit the Left Hand Voodoo thing. Then Undead Anna kind of dismembered the
and
blue.
And before you move on, as an outsider looking
at Greg Riley.
There you go. Yeah. See?
I knew it would come to me. Sorry, Greg, if you ever hear this.
From a fan perspective, an outsider perspective, those are two kick-ass names. And I think a lot of people would agree with me on that, that those bands had cool names and you guys always had really good artwork. And I'm looking at some of the promotion in your room here. And I think that was really a cool thing on your side.
Well, the Left Hand Voodoo name came from when I was playing blues. I don't have you ever met Cheddar Bob? Bob Glanz? Older guy, looks like Jerry Garcia.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
So Bob, like, started following us around at shows, and he's a big blues head. And he just somehow, at a show one night, he was just, or we played a party, and he's like, man, I'd love to come see you guys practice sometime. I was just like, yeah, sure. Here's where I live. Come. I thought, this guy's never going to show up. Well, sure enough, he shows up. And he shows up every time.
Oh.
So when we would be playing, and like he was like, let me get some more of that left hand. You know, he's wanting you to play some more right, lead.
More lead.
And so he was like, man, I love it when you do that left hand voodoo, man. You know? Oh, wow. And so he ended up getting a tattoo on his arm that said left hand voodoo.
Super cool.
Ken sees him out at some point and says, man, I love that. Could we name our band that? And he's like, sure, go ahead. So that's where that came
from. That's fantastic.
Yeah. And, I think I think Atomic Pimp Hand. No, here's what the was Atomic. I think one of Atomic Pimp Hands. I think their CD was called Left Hand Voodoo.
Interesting.
And it just kind of morphed from there. Yeah. And then the Atomic or the Undead Anna thing. I asked Kyle a ton of times what it meant, and he never would tell me. So
it was just something that
he came up with. Yeah. We all thought it was cool. I still don't know what it means. Hmm. Apparently,
maybe we don't need to go there.
Apparently, it was very personal.
When you're dealing with the dead, you don't want to.
He never told me, and I was just like, whatever. So
he's on my list.
Yeah.
To interview.
Well, he probably, if he tells you, I'm going to be pissed because I never even knew what it was.
I'll find out the world exclusive.
Yeah.
Well, so obviously, left-handed voodoo with
left-hand voodoo,
left-hand,
not
voodoo.
Left-handed.
Well, you know. Left Hand Voodoo
yeah.
with Jason on drums
uh-huh.
and Ken on vocals
uh-huh.
evolves into Boomstick.
Yes and
so
no.
This is fairly somewhat.
Well, what happened current. Then is Ken and I started this Boomstick thing with the drummer and bass player that now is with Gravel Switch. That was the first rhythm section that.
The original?
The ones that are with them now.
Oh, the guys from Harley, Out of the Ashes.
Yeah.
So Harley,
Harley
and Cameron.
Yeah, Harley and Cameron played our first. I think they played one show with us.
Wow.
And that was the original.
I didn't know that.
Concept. Yeah, we only did one show. And then Out of the Ashes was still kind of doing their thing. Right. So they kind of.
Yeah, they seemed to do fairly well for
well,
a while. I know Dustin was like pretty active guy.
Well, Left Hand Voodoo played with them quite a bit too. So we were all kind of friends. And so anyways, when that happened, Left Hand Voodoo kind of had fell apart. So I was like, well, we'll just see if Jason wants to play drums. And he did. And Pope was playing with Downpour at the time,
yes.
or had just finished playing with.
Yeah, them. Downpour came out of
Slander.
Yeah, Slander, and John Fox's involvement.
Slander begot Downpour, begot Boomstick. You know, kind of the whole Old Testament thing. But anyway, so we ended up getting Pope to play bass with us, and then Shane Williams, the original Boomstick was five piece.
Right, the first album was five piece. Now did
Shane
play
on? He played
on the second
one
album
as well. Yeah.
But he didn't do any of the shows.
He played on it, and that was about the time he kind of just went and did his thing.
Okay.
So
you guys have been a four piece for a pretty decent
amount, probably
like almost 2 years at this point.
Probably 2 years.
And you've released the two records,
right?
Cocked and Loaded.
Uh-huh.
And, see, now I'm doing it. I can't remember.
Rocked and Loaded.
Rocked and Loaded.
Rocked and Loaded. And the first one was Crunch, I think.
Why did I
was
say
it Crunch?
Cocked and Loaded?
That's Rocked and Loaded.
Well, fuck.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Crunch was the first
the Crunch.
One. The Crunch. Yeah.
Which was cool because you guys, like,
Which has a meaning. It has two meanings.
Is it bad?
I'll tell you the one that's not bad.
Okay, tell me the.
I can tell you both of them. I don't know.
You can say whatever you want.
So the version of the meaning that we told everybody was crunch was a common.
Cocked and Loaded as a porn. So I apologize.
Yeah, no problem. So crunch was a mixture of crunch and raunch, which is crunch.
Huh.
But what it's really a
that's
slang.
PG.
It's really a slang term for. Woman's privates.
Really?
Yeah.
Like in a skanky format?
That's just what we called it. The crunch.
Interesting.
I don't
know. Like these things are invented.
It was one of those nights we'd been drinking beer, you know, and crunch came up.
Interesting.
Actually, I think that came from back in the Cave City days when I used to hang out on the strip, and I think Big Rick Woodard came up with the crunch, like talking about a lady's privates, so.
Well,
How
about
anyways,
that?
Yeah.
Well, Boomstick has been going, like you said, for a couple of years.
Yep.
You are the guitarist,
uh-huh.
which is, in my opinion, where you belong.
I like both. Hey, I could say the same for you.
You do every time. You're like, man, it's cool that you're playing bass and all, but I think you need to be playing drums. Well, I've had the privilege to play drums with you a few times, and you are a phenomenal guitar player, and I mean that sincerely. I'm sitting right here in your home studio right now, staring at this beautiful orange head and cabinet that you have. You've also been known to have some pretty damn nice Marshalls.
Yeah, actually, it's funny because right now I have the least amount of equipment I've ever had.
Yes,
that's the only amp I
sell a lot. And I know you've traded a lot.
Well, you know, at one time I had a ton of guitars. I had like 13 or 14 nice guitars. Yeah. And it just got to the point where, you know, I had them. It was a pain in the ass to figure out which one I was going to take to the gig. And I would always end up picking the same two or three. Right. So I was just like, it's stupid for me to have these and them just sitting and collecting dust when they're good guitars. Somebody else could be playing them. So.
Well, I know that you mentioned earlier that you've had some nice Fenders. But I am known seeing you with a lot of Les Pauls. Mm-hmm. That seems to be your go-to
choice. That's always been my... That's what I started when I got my first electric that I really got and played a lot was a Epiphone Les Paul.
You just like the feel and the...
I like the feel, and all my favorite rock guitar players played them. Jerry Cantrell played a Les Paul, Zakk Wylde, Slash.
Especially on the recordings. Yeah. I mean, it can stands out on...
And it just, man, they just, they feel good. To me, they look good. They're curvy. Mm-hmm. You know, they're shaped like a woman. Yeah. You know? They're curvy. They're nice.
Well, it's just like when I see you, especially on stage, and you guys are known to have some, not only, like, I know Wade Ford is involved and does a lot of, like, light show. Mm-hmm. Like, he goes and travels with you guys in a way. It seems like you always have outstanding stage performance setups, and there's always someone in the crowd that seems to have like quality camera equipment. So I see some of the best photos taken of you guys on stage, but there's always, from every show, a shot of you that's perfect. and you're always holding, you know, Les Paul.
I know you're
in the pose. And it's
say, like, when you go out to a restaurant, you eat with your eyes first. I think the same can be said about music.
Yeah.
I mean, how many times have you went to see a band and looked up and been like, these guys are going to be terrible.
Right.
Just
because of the gear.
But, I mean, how many times have you went to see a band where they, like, look the part, and even though they're not that great, you're just like, I kind of like this. You know, I feel like that's where we fall. We're by no means a great band. We have a good time, and we really don't care whether you like it or not. We're all about doing it. At this point in our lives, we're doing it for us.
Right.
But we also care enough to try to make it look...
Well, it looks good. It does sound good. And you guys are an original band, but you also do choice... Mm-hmm. selection of covers, and I mean great selection. So anyone that's seen you obviously knows what I'm talking about. Your show is a damn show. I mean, it's legit, and it's got both elements of your originality and your covers, and obviously it's a band decision. So you guys do a really good job of picking not only good songs, but a good variety.
I think a lot of the whole show thing comes from Ken, just because Ken comes from the era of the 80s hair metal bands, and, you know, he's always been about
putting that show out there,
having the visual, and to you know, that's probably up there as far, you know, as much as the musicianship for him.
Absolutely.
For me, it is kind of too. I mean, I like it, but I'm more... Well, probably the covers that we choose, that's more of my thing, just because I've been influenced by so many different things. But, like, a big influence I had was, like, the 80s pop stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I was also heavily influenced, like we've talked about, from the California punk scene.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the...
I know you're a big Social
Distortion Social D, Pennywise, you know, even the punk pop stuff, you know, Blink 182, Offspring, Me First and Gimme Gimme's, that, you know, just that kind of... I always said it was cool to hear a band play a song, like a pop song, but play it punked up.
Right.
And to me, like...
Kind of a stripped down...
I just love it, you know, or play a rap song and play it...
Yeah.
In a rock style.
And you guys seem to kind of have that. Like,
yeah,
I've seen you do certain songs, and I know that you've recorded a few of them, mm-hmm. you know, and you guys definitely put your spin on it, you know, and it's cool stuff.
Well, if you kind of put your spin on it, then people can't really, they can say it sucks, but we're doing it the way we want to do it, you know.
Well, not to confuse this with anything, but just for anyone listening that may not know who you are, if they are to look up anything on Boomstick,
mm-hmm.
it is Boomstick spelled S-T-I-K.
Yes, no C.
There is another band, like, I think within the region, possibly. Called Boomstick, and it's spelled normal.
Possibly.
And because I've looked it up, mm-hmm. the name, when you first got this going, I kind of looked around to find the pages mm-hmm. and listen and all that stuff. And I came across bands called Boomstick in normal spelling.
Yeah.
So I don't know, anyone out there listening, just be careful of how you type it in.
Always no C. You
know, but it's easy to spot because, again, you guys have a great logo design. You've got great art design, and everything on your social media pages seems to be really
Zach from stuff. West Main Tattoo hooked us up with the cool skull gas mask logo. Oh, it's great. So.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. He's an excellent artist. Good dude, too. And a good musician, actually. Yeah, if you can get him, if you can ever get him to play.
Where do I go from here, Wade? Is there anything I'm missing? Is there anything you want to talk about as far as the local music scene goes?
Not really. You know, we just
kind
of...
Any particular bands out there you're a fan of?
Today? Like local bands?
Yeah. Past or present? I know you mentioned Superfuzz.
That's like...
Tail Dragger.
That's like, Superfuzz. Superfuzz, to me, is like on that pedestal. That's the pinnacle, yeah. Like, there's Alice in Chains, and then the next step down is Superfuzz. Right.
I get that.
That's kind of, you know, the two dudes that I saw play where I thought I really have to do that was Jerry Cantrell and Dave Angstrom. Probably especially Dave Angstrom. It was the first live music I'd ever seen, right. And it just like blew me away because
they were phenomenal.
He was a banshee. I saw them. He was just all over the place.
I saw Superfuzz at least 5 times,
dude. I saw him back in the day. Like if they were playing a Wednesday in Louisville, I didn't care. I'd go see him. You know, I was a groupie. I followed them around.
Every time they played in Bowling Green. That's really it.
I'll put it this way: where I worked. We worked on computers some, and Dean Smith brought his computer in, and I saw the work order, and it said Dean Smith. I freaked out, you know, because I didn't know Dean at the time. Right. And since me and him have become good friends, same deal with Dave. I'm privileged that I got to know all those guys, and you know, I can shoot Dave a text, and he'll actually answer me back.
That's cool.
I actually sold him a guitar a couple years ago.
That's cool.
They're just kind of one of those, you know, how. Like, as far as local music, they were it, you know.
Yeah.
And I think if you ask any of the guys from Blackstone Cherry, they'll say the same
thing. Oh, I know.
It was always Dave and then everybody else, you know.
Well, and I think Super a lot Fuzz of you guys around the Glasgow area seem to have a much stronger connection.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, a lot of it would reach Bowling Green, but it wasn't always
mm-hmm.
as dominant. Down there, I think, as it did maybe in Lexington and Louisville and some of the other areas. I always considered Glasgow part of the northern music scene in a way. I mean,
I guess
it's just weird to me because I grew up in Bowling Green and spent a lot of time in Nashville.
Yeah.
And to me, that was its own little
We just
clique.
Had nothing to do, man. There's nothing to do in Glasgow besides
You guys had
music.
A lot of talent. Come from here, you've had a lot of opportunity
mm-hmm.
to get with various musicians and bands to watch and learn mm-hmm. and it seemed like it was a very just giving scene up here.
Yeah, it really was.
Didn't seem competitive to me when I first came into it. It's like everybody's friends, everybody's almost family.
Everybody kind of started doing it at the same time, and you know, like back in the 90s and even 70s on up, you know, back when you had Itchy Brother and, you know, Buster Brown and all those cats.
And I've had this conversation with a few people already because I've talked to some people connected deeply to this area. And they all say the same thing, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like we just had this really rich musical root
mm-hmm.
that is connected to the Bowling Green music scene. But it's also very much kind of home here.
Yeah. Well, it all goes back to Kenny.
Everybody leaves here and goes there to play, but the clubs came and went so fast that we were lucky to be able to catch a band from here down there.
Right.
You know, and so, and now that there's a lot of venues here, you guys are able to play home more often than you used to. So
that's pretty cool. Well, there's no really rock venues here anymore.
Well, I think Riblickers is doing good.
Well, yeah, Riblickers. Riblickers is, but yeah, you know.
I think it's changing.
I think it'll pick up. It goes in cycles. So maybe it'll fire back up. Who knows?
So what, back to that one question though, is there any bands locally speaking now that kind of stand out to you that you're a fan of?
No Deceit. I'm a huge fan of those guys. I really like what they do. They bring a lot of energy. Otis, you know, obviously, I mean, they're local, but they're kind of touring and doing their thing now. Dude, there's so many. I know I'm at least Luther, which they're still around from back in the day.
Yep.
They just kicked our ass last week at that show.
And I played a show with them the weekend before
so intense.
In Nashville. And it's like, just to be in their presence.
They're kind of in the same realm as Superfuzz. They're like rock royalty around here, you know. But, I mean, there's a lot of good bands, you know. I don't get out as much as I used to. I mean, I even like a lot of them.
But you do keep up with it.
Yeah, I try to. You know, like we went and saw Peter the Freshman at Riblickers a couple weeks ago. And I kind of joked with them that, I think I posted something about this is your mom's favorite band because and my wife, dude,
she doesn't know it yet.
My wife was like just flabbergasted by them. She was just having so much fun watching them.
I was at that show.
Yeah, you were.
Like the audience just had a ball.
Oh, it was great. I mean, any bands like that are fun. And you know, there's a lot of bands that we've played with that I dig. But you know, as far as like trying to get out and go see people, like anytime No Deceit's in the area, I try to go see them just because they're a lot of fun.
And
the funny thing about it, that's not really my style of music.
But you guys do.
They're very country-ish, but they're so intense,
right?
You know.
And I think when you guys have played shows together, I think it's a good fit because it may be slightly different, but yet it is kind of matched. From just the stage presence, the showmanship, the song selection of both bands. Like, it is opposite, but it's very much in the same universe, too, you know? And I think it's a good pairing.
Yeah. I really don't get to get out and see as much music as I would like to right now. Hopefully that's going to change soon because I'll be retired.
Yeah. Retired at how old?
I'll be 43.
So when I tell you you're smart, I'm not kidding.
Maybe.
Who wouldn't want to be retired at 43?
I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Well, I think you made a smart choice in that decision.
I'm not complaining.
You could complain 20 years ago when you were younger and having to get up and go to work all the time.
Yeah.
But it has paid off for you. What does the future have in store for not only Boomstick, but for Wade England?
As far as Boomstick, we actually, we're going to have a little EP coming out soon.
Cool. So that'll be your third release.
Yeah. And it's kind of going to be a little fun, different thing. It'll have four covers and an original that nobody's heard that we've never played out.
Great.
And we're just kind of working on finishing that up. As far as me, I don't know. We'll just kind of have to see.
Playing guitar, hanging out.
Yeah, play guitar. See what happens. You know, cook some food, go, you know. Who knows?
Saints?
Yeah, go Saints indeed. Yeah, hopefully by the
obviously this
hopefully
will
by,
air.
The, by the time this is aired, hopefully I'll be able, you know, there'll be
hopefully
Super
you'll
Bowl
have another Super Bowl,
Super Bowl champs and that'll make my year and be a great birthday present for me.
Well, I hope when you listen back to this that you can say I was right.
Yeah, if not, hey, it was a good run. You know?
Yeah, you guys definitely had a good season.
Yeah.
Well, Wade, I've known you for a long time. I've gotten to know you a lot better recently over the years, and especially
and for some reason, you still come and talk to me.
Ah, that old joke.
Yeah.
But I've had the privilege of knowing you, getting to work with you on stage, especially at, like blues jams. Mm-hmm. You've had me up to your house before to jam a few or once at least. And I think we've talked about doing some more stuff. You've guessed on one of my songs, which hasn't come out yet, but it eventually will.
Still waiting to hear that.
You have always been a solid guy to me. You've been nothing but nice over the years, and I think very highly of you. And I can say on behalf of myself and many other in the music scene that we appreciate what you do, and we are thankful to have you in it.
I'm thankful to be appreciated.
You're a good dude, man. And I think anybody out there listening to this, where can they look up anything on you, musically speaking?
Facebook, pretty much.
Do you have anything on the sites like Spotify? And
yeah,
I guess if you just Google these band names, you might find something. Yeah, if you Google the bands,
I think Undead Anna's on Spotify, probably Boomstick's on there. I don't know. I mean, I've...
Just Google it.
Yeah, Google it. Facebook me. You know, I'm there somewhere doing something. You'll well, see me out.
I hope you keep doing things, man, because you're a solid talent, and I am personally a fan.
Thank you.
I have attended many of your shows because you guys are just not only cool, but musically I enjoy it, and you put on a good show. And I appreciate you taking the time to do this. Well,
thank you for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Anytime, buddy. Have a good one.